Hi, Marco Werman here. You know my voice from the show, but what you don't often hear are the voices who work behind the scenes. Many talented people bring you the world each day. If you've ever wondered who makes our show, come meet us at theworld.org/whoweare. You'll see the superhero staff that makes the world what it is. The World's Newsroom digs deep into every story, takes risks, and shines a light on the communities most impacted by the headlines. Please take a moment to meet our staff. You'll find us at theworld.org/whoweare. And while you're there, you can also make a difference today in the work that we do by donating $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. Your gift can help us keep the show accessible to everybody. Help us make our goal, $100,000 from at least 1,000 donors, and you'll receive a personal invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make the show. Once again, visit theworld.org/whoweare to learn about our team and donate today. From everybody here at The World, thanks. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you here. President-elect Joe Biden today formally announced the first of his cabinet picks.
Together, these public servants will restore America globally, its global leadership, and its moral leadership.
That includes Tony Blinken as Secretary of State.
And he will rebuild morale and trust in the State Department, where his career in government began.
If confirmed, Blinken will lead a troubled department in need of a morale boost after it was devastated in many ways under President Trump. But many former Foreign Service officers say the problems began before Trump. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
President Trump promoted fewer State Department career employees to ambassadorships than ever before. Harvard professor and former Foreign Service officer Nick Burns says professional staff weren't included in major policy decisions. Trump tried to cut the department's budget by a third. Many career professionals have left, morale is low, and Burns says the State Department is in profound crisis.
So I do think President Trump bears a large share of responsibility, but not total responsibility, because there are structural problems.
Burns and his colleagues talked to 200 former and current Foreign Service officers for a report that suggests ways to address those structural problems.
These amount to a call for radical change and almost a reimagining of what diplomats need to do to protect the United States in the future.
The report says Congress should pass the first new Foreign Service Act in 40 years to overhaul the State Department. It says legislators should redefine the department's mission, revamp its personnel system to make it more transparent and based on merit, create a mid-level entry program, reduce the number of political appointees, and put career employees in more key positions.
This is quite controversial. You can imagine that both political parties, you know, aren't happy to see people recommending a major change, but we think major change is needed.
Especially to reach what many see as the most vital goal for the new State Department, diversity in all the ranks. The lack of representation has been a weakness, like when the State Department had no connections inside Muslim communities to help combat extremism, says Farah Pandit.
We realized that we didn't have insights to the experience of how these young people were growing up post 9/11.
To help address that need, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appointed Pandit the first special representative to Muslim communities. Pandit, who's now also at Harvard, says there are many other cultural expertise gaps to fill.
Where are all the places that we don't have insight, that we haven't asked questions, that we haven't built programs? And isn't it the time now to be able to look to that, so that, God forbid, in a time of crisis, that we have those connections, we have the insights, we understand, and we're not scrambling.
But people have been talking about the need to change and diversify the State Department nearly as long as there's been a State Department, says Chris Richardson. He resigned from State in 2017 because he disagreed with Trump policies, like the travel ban from several Muslim-majority nations. In June, Richardson wrote a New York Times op-ed titled, "The State Department Was Designed to Keep African Americans Out."
We need to have that larger conversation about the historical context so that we have a better understanding of what is the culture of the State Department that is allowing these things to continue. And that maybe the cultural problem might be the fact that we talk a lot about this stuff and we make a bunch of papers about it, but there is no intentional desire for change.
Richardson says early on in the State Department's history, officials found excuses through exams and security clearances to keep black people out. He says for the department to move forward, that history has to be acknowledged, and also the fact that the discrimination persists. In recent years, Black representation has decreased slightly, even as the Black Lives Matter movement has touched off demonstrations and activism around the globe. Richardson says State Department employees who represent the U.S. need to be able to talk about issues like that.
The countries abroad, they know America's story. Let's be honest about our own faults, our own failures as a country, and that makes us more credible when we talk to other countries about their human rights abuses.
The Biden administration might take the right steps, Richardson says. He's always hopeful for real change. Tiana Spears is a bit more skeptical. She resigned from the State Department in January.
At the end of the day, I really hope for change, and I also know better. I'm very much waiting to see what happens before I get my hopes up.
Spears had an assignment that required her to regularly cross back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico. She says she was racially profiled and harassed by Customs and Border Patrol, and when she told her white superiors, they did nothing. Spears says many people of color inside the State Department have similar stories.
It's going to take holding upper management accountable for their actions. That's how you get change.
Spears says if there are no repercussions for racism and discrimination, it will continue. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
President-elect Biden's pick to be U.S. ambassador to the U.N. did not take what might be considered a typical path to international diplomacy. Linda Thomas Greenfield grew up in segregated Louisiana, where the local KKK burned crosses in people's yards. Her father left school in third grade to help support his family. Her mother had an eighth grade education. Here's how Thomas Greenfield described her early days at Louisiana State University in a recent TEDx talk.
I was harassed in my dormitory. I had a world-renowned historian use the N-word regularly in a classroom. One of my professors gave me an F in a class, and when I asked why he'd given me the F, he said to me, "If you don't know the answer to that question, you don't need to be here." But what he didn't understand was that failure was not an option for me.
Thomas Greenfield went on to excel in the U.S. Foreign Service and spent 35 years there. She served as U.S. ambassador to Liberia and directed the Bureau of African Affairs. Thomas Greenfield often crossed paths with U.S. Ambassador Johnny Carson. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, as well as the U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Uganda. Johnny Carson is with me now. Ambassador Carson, thanks very much for being here. Why do you think President-elect Biden's team chose Linda Thomas Greenfield for this coveted position?
She's capable, collegial, and she's politically savvy. She is deeply respected for her views on the Hill, both among Democrats and Republicans. She will bring back a level of dignity and respect to the leadership at the UN mission. And I think that many of our partners there will welcome her diplomatic prowess and skills.
Her early years, Linda Thomas Greenfield's early years, as I mentioned, were full of adversity, attending Louisiana State University when David Duke, who would go on to become the Grand Wizard of the KKK, he was a student there at the time. How did those years impact her worldview?
Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield is not easily rattled and very difficult to push around. She maintains her values and her principles and is willing to stand up and speak out when pushed the wrong way or in the face of adversity.
She was stationed in Rwanda, notably in 1994 during the genocide there. And in her TEDx talk, she describes how she was almost caught up in the killing there after being mistaken for a local Rwandan.
I was confronted by a glazed-eyed young man who had been given instructions to kill a woman by the name of a goth. And he thought that I was a goth. And interestingly, I didn't panic. I was afraid, don't get me wrong, but I didn't panic. And I looked that young man in the eyes and I asked him his name and I told him mine. I wanted him to know my name because if he killed me, I wanted him to know the name of the person he'd killed.
Just a note to that, Agathe, the woman she was mentioning, was eventually killed.
The person that young man was trying to kill was in the adjacent house where Linda was staying, and it was, in fact, the country's prime minister. She faced death, and not many people come face-to-face with death overseas in front of armed men from a different military. Her life could have been taken not only in that instance, but also as she was in one of the lead cars and convoy leading out of the country with American citizens and embassy employees.
If confirmed, Ambassador Thomas Greenfield would have a lot of work to do to change minds at the UN. The Trump administration has cut its UN contributions, withdrawn from agencies and global treaties. What will be her approach, do you think?
I think she will go about rebuilding ties with our closest allies. She will not be pushing an America alone agenda. She will be working on behalf of an administration that believes that America is and should be a part of the responsible global community. There's no doubt in my mind that she'll work hard to restore American dignity and commitment to the importance of the United Nations as an instrument of helping to advance global peace and security, but also helping to advance a better world for everyone.
Retired U.S. Ambassador Johnny Carson was the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, as well as Ambassador to Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Uganda. He's been telling us about President-elect Joe Biden's pick as U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Ambassador, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Another cabinet pick officially named today is John Kerry. The former Secretary of State will fill a new position created by Biden, the President's Climate Envoy.
For the first time ever, there will be a principal on the National Security Council who can make sure climate change is on the agenda in the Situation Room. For the first time ever, we will have a presidential envoy on climate.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, reports on the new high-profile role.
Tapping someone with John Kerry's political resume is a signal that the U.S. is doing a complete 180 on climate policy.
This just demonstrates the president-elect is taking this crisis incredibly seriously.
This is former U.S. climate negotiator Elan Strait.
The rest of the world is excited and relieved to see that after the last 4 years.
Global leaders know Kerry from his role as America's top diplomat during the negotiations leading up to the Paris Climate Agreement.
His Excellency, the Secretary of State of the United States of America.
Kerry somewhat famously signed the pact with his young granddaughter on his lap. The longtime senator worked on climate change for decades, including trying, unsuccessfully, to push through a sweeping climate bill in 2009. When Kerry took over the State Department during the second Obama term, Elan Strait says climate change was a top priority on day one.
The first cable that he sent out to every ambassador in the world was about climate change. He is bringing a real commitment to this issue, and I don't think that ends with just re-entering the Paris Agreement.
Kerry will also have a seat on the White House National Security Council, a first for a climate advisor.
It's a big step.
Sherry Goodman is a former deputy undersecretary of defense who's now with the Center for Climate and Security.
John Kerry sitting at the National Security Council with the Secretary of State, defense, national security advisor, and intelligence officials will be able to weigh in on all major decisions, everything from our policies towards China, Russia, North Korea, Iran.
Policies in the Arctic, where sea ice melting is opening up a northern sea route for trade, and in the Middle East and North Africa, where drought underlies conflicts in Syria and parts of the Sahel.
We will now be able fully to mainstream climate security risks throughout our foreign policy and national security planning.
Last year, Kerry helped start a bipartisan group called World War Zero. It tapped celebrities and politicians to call attention to the climate crisis. In an appearance on Meet the Press, Kerry framed the issue as an international emergency.
We are way behind the eight ball. And so we've got to treat this like a war. I mean, it has to require decision making and organization and efforts that are just not taking place.
That won't be easy. John Kerry now has to convince the world that the U.S. can help lead on climate change after 4 years of the Trump administration distancing itself from efforts to cut carbon emissions. To do that, the Biden administration will have to take domestic policy action, too, and quickly. So Kerry's success, in part, hinges on the success of a yet-to-be-named climate advisor focused on the U.S. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Egypt, there is again a crackdown on human rights activists. The government's target this time is an organization called the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, or EIPR. The group's executive director, Gasser Abdelrazek, was arrested last week, one of three members of the organization recently detained. Amr Magdi joins me to talk about what's going on. He's a researcher with Human Rights Watch, focusing on the Middle East and North Africa. Amr, how do you explain this latest crackdown? Why is all of this happening now?
Right. So the arrests seem in direct retaliation for a meeting between the EIPR staff and several of the EU and US diplomats and ambassadors in Egypt that happened in early November. These meetings are very important because Western officials and international groups need to know what's happening on the ground in Egypt. And since 2016, at least, the leading human rights activists in the country have been under travel ban. They are disconnected from the outside world. The organization has been at the center of a relentless government crackdown on civil society and independent groups that has escalated so much when Sisi rose to power in 2014. I think the mentality that governs the government perception of civil society is that it is a threat to the society. The government has pretty much managed to stifle or obliterate any space for independent, peaceful assembly or gathering, and also kill the political life. And so the only thing that remained resisting this nationwide crackdown was the independent human rights groups. And that's why the government really wants to get rid of these brave defenders.
So as to that meeting on November 3rd, how risky was it to have that meeting? Did the human rights activists know that they could face a strong crackdown in the wake of it?
Well, the organization has been at the center of the government crackdown. More than 60 staff members of several human rights organizations in Egypt have been called for interrogations, have been also under continuous persecution. So it's not an exaggeration to say that the civil society in Egypt has been facing an existential threat in the past years under the government of President Sisi. In that sense, they are fully aware of the risks. However, you try to maneuver, you try to resist this oppression. This meeting with the Western diplomats was not unique. These are meetings that happen frequently, but definitely the message here that the government wants to send is that this is unacceptable and the international community cannot care for human rights in Egypt, and those defenders can also go to jail for doing their work.
If EIPR is at the center of this crackdown, Amr, can you tell us more about Gasser Abdelrazek, EIPR's executive director? How large a figure is he in human rights organizing activities in Egypt?
I've only known Gasser for, I would say, 6 years or so, but he's actually one of the earlier generation of the human rights defenders in Egypt from the 1990s. He's a very well-respected figure. He's been running the EIPR for the past 5 years. So yes, his arrest is really shocking. His treatment in detention is even more shocking. They are keeping him in solitary confinement in a cold cell without enough clothes. He doesn't have a mattress to sleep on. He was not allowed to see his wife and kids until now.
Wow. Do you wonder whether arresting Abdelrazek is a message to other human rights groups in Egypt? And how are they reacting to this news? And what does it mean for an accurate picture of how the government is attacking human rights going forward?
Absolutely. I think there is analysis that the timing of this crackdown is to send a signal to the international community as well as the Egyptian human rights organizations, as Biden administration is coming to office, that the international attention to human rights in Egypt is not acceptable under President Trump. Sisi and other authoritarian rulers felt sort of a green pass to go on with their abuses and to oppress their citizens, and maybe the timing of this arrest is to signal that any change of these rules will not be tolerated. Definitely, this is a very chilling signal to the Egyptian civil society as a whole. There is already very, very few organizations left operating from inside Egypt. Most of the international and Egyptian organizations had to leave the country in recent years and operate from outside Egypt. Definitely, if this crackdown on the EIPR is not stopped immediately, we can see more arrests and more detentions underway.
There has been criticism from some parts of the globe. I saw that Joe Biden's pick for Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, came out and expressed concern about the situation in Egypt, and Egypt's foreign ministry responded that it rejects any outside influence. It does make me wonder what influence the incoming Biden administration will have on the Sisi government if it's digging its heels in. What do you think, and what are you hoping for?
We are not expecting dramatic changes in the sense that Sisi will be forced to change courses. But at least we expect from Biden's administration to put human rights at the center of their bilateral relationships. We want to see the military aid to Egypt, which is the second biggest recipient of U.S. aid in the whole world. We want to see that aid conditioned and halted on concrete human rights improvement and the end of the crackdown on civil society. The U.S. has very large and significant leverage on the Egyptian government. They can pressure them to respect rights. And in the past few days, we have seen an international outcry that was not bad in the sense that a lot of Western governments, diplomats, officials, and including the UN as well, have spoken out, have condemned these arrests and the crackdown. But we want to see that these words have more than just condemnation. We want to see action. We want to see consequences for the Egyptian government if they do not release those human rights defenders.
The human rights situation in Egypt is not new. It's been a concern before President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi came to power, and it's even more worrying now, according to many activists. Has this become the norm now in Egypt? Is there any hope for change under Sisi?
Unfortunately, it has become the norm. That's true. Egypt has never been a democracy. We know that there have been always oppressive rulers. President Mubarak stayed in power for 30 years, but he at least allowed a margin for free expression, for political mobilization and independent organization, especially in the late 10 years of his rule. Under President Sisi, we are seeing unprecedented crackdown in Egypt's recent history. Tens of thousands of political activists, journalists, human rights activists have been thrown in jail. And it's extremely risky to offer the slightest criticism for the government. Unfortunately, yes, that has been the situation. I think the hope for peaceful change always remains, but it has shrunk so much. And that's the long-term dangerous effect of suppressing the civil society, because in such restrictive environment, only extremist ideologies and violent groups can survive. If that continues for a few years, the society will be emptied from all its peaceful activists. And that's precisely what is dangerous for the country's future.
Amr Magdi is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. He's been speaking with us from Berlin about the situation in Egypt currently. Amr, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
More news and stories from around the globe just ahead. You're listening to The World. A reminder to listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to the voices of the people most affected by the news. Donate to The World today to support the work of our superhero staff and help us keep our coverage free and open to all. You can help keep the show accessible to everybody across the globe by donating $100. That's just $8.33 a month. Help us make our goal and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make this show possible. To give, visit theworld.org/whoweare or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe. Stay healthy, and thank you. 2020 has given us a whole new language.
Personal protective equipment.
Super spreader.
Blurs date.
Anti-mask.
Doom scrolling.
Too many new words and phrases to pick just one that sum up this year. That's ahead, as well as an update from Ethiopia on a conflict that seems to be escalating, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. No mercy. That's how the Ethiopian government is viewing dissident forces in the northern region of Tigray. The leader of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, has declared that his people are ready to die. That's a quote. The fighting between Ethiopian government forces and the TPLF started less than 3 weeks ago. It escalated quickly. Already hundreds of people are believed to have been killed. More than 40,000 have fled to neighboring Sudan. The world's Halima Gikandi is in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. What is the latest from that region, Halima? What are you hearing?
Well, first, it's important to note that communications in the north have been completely shut off for the past 3 weeks. So news is difficult to get from there, and very few independent journalists have been able to visit the area. So really, all we have to rely on is what the government says and what the TPLF, or Tigray People's Liberation Front, has to say. But overall, on the government side, they've been painting an optimistic picture that this conflict will be over soon, even though the TPLF has been reportedly launching rockets to neighboring areas and destroying airports. Here's Redwan Hussein speaking at a press conference on Monday. He's the spokesperson of the country's new emergency task force that's handling this issue.
By and large, now the Tigray region is under the control of our defense forces. And now it's moving forward to Mekelle.
And Mekelle is the capital city of Tigray. So what the government is saying is that they've already encircled it. And over the weekend, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed gave the TPLF and its militias 72 hours to give up arms before they plan to move in and capture the city.
What's been the response to this ultimatum from the TPLF in Tigray?
The TPLF has shown no signs of backing down at all, and they seem to be well-armed and determined to keep a grip on power. Here's Rev leader Debretsion Gebremichael, who spoke recently at a press conference. He called on Tigrayans to continue fighting and said not for them not to give up until they won. He also said that the federal government was attacking them based on their identity, which the government has completely denied. Ebretian also said that their forces are strengthening and achieving victories despite being completely outmatched. But again, because of the communications and media blackout, it's really not clear what the reality on the ground is.
So TPLF leaders are saying they're not giving up, and the 72-hour deadline puts us into tomorrow. Are we expecting a big military offensive in the next coming days?
A good question. Again, not clear because communications have been down. And I have to note, this isn't the first ultimatum from the government in the past 3 weeks. That said, according to them, that's the plan. And over the weekend, there was a general who was quoted saying that the military will come in with tanks and heavy artillery. He told people to essentially flee for their lives. And for human rights groups, that's been a big warning sign. They've been calling on all parties to protect civilians. And also, Marco, I have to note that there are 500,000 people in Mekelle.
You're in Addis Ababa, Halima. That's the Ethiopian capital. What do things look like from there? What is the mood?
It depends who you ask, really. Addis Ababa is very far from the conflict. It's some 600 miles, which is about the distance from Washington, D.C. to Florida. So things here are very calm. Life has continued. But flights to Tigray and even other bordering areas have been cut off completely. So here, it really seems like we're living in two completely different worlds. The streets in the Ethiopian capital are busy. Shopping malls are full. At night, the bars and cafes are filled with young people. Communications with Tigray in the north, on the other hand, are blocked. So Ethiopians mostly hear about what's happening there from the government, and they're paying attention. I spoke with a young street vendor named Minale Kasahun. Kasahun says he completely supports Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's campaign against the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. The TPLF was once the dominant political party in Ethiopia before Abiy came to power in 2018. It's been linked to massive corruption and human rights abuses, Kasahun says. He says this is a conflict against the TPLF party, not the people of Tigray. That's something Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been trying to drive home. But many Tigrayans, people from Tigray, don't see things that way. They feel targeted. Most haven't heard from their family members back home in weeks. I met shopkeeper Addis Alem Mazmour as she was folding clothes behind her counter. That's Orthodox Christian music playing in the background. Mazmour is originally from Tigray. Mesmer tells me she doesn't know if her family back home is alive or dead. This isn't her first experience with war either. She says she used to live in Syria. Her husband is Syrian, but they fled the violence and she returned home to Ethiopia, hoping it would be safe. But now it doesn't feel that way. War doesn't solve anything, Mesmer says. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed might claim that the conflict is coming to an end, but she says she's worried about what happens next in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Addis Ababa.
More time at home means for many of us more time looking at screens, Zoom meetings, Zoom hangouts, binging new TV series. Not surprisingly, video games have exploded in popularity during the pandemic. And with that, renewed concerns about how the increased screen time might be impacting our health. A team at Oxford University took a look at this. They found that, maybe contrary to what you'd expect, playing certain games like Animal Crossing can actually improve well-being. But what's more interesting is how they got there, by studying gaming in a new, more rigorous way. Andrew Shabelsky is the director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute. So we'll get to the meat of your study in a sec, Andrew, but talk first about your approach. You used a specific type of data that hasn't really been looked at much before. What is that data? How'd you use it? And why is it a departure from the way games and the way people interact with them have been studied in the past?
The study that we did probably should have been done 20 years ago. Most work on video games and their possible effects, it relies on people participating in studies to estimate the amount of time they spend playing games, and also estimate how they feel, in terms of their well-being. And what we did in the study, the thing that's a departure or novel, is we bothered to collect the objective data, working with Nintendo and Electronic Arts in this instance, to see whether or not, you know, the kinds of data that they collect to make money or to do quality assurance, whether or not that data was suitable for scientific research.
There has been a lot of fear about gaming over the years, that certain games could be addictive, maybe even make some kids more violent. Are you saying that possibly these fears could be based on not much evidence or not very rigorous research?
Yeah, I'm saying exactly that. I mean, our fears and concerns about video games go back to the late 1970s with the rise of arcade games. So in the States, there was a lot of focus on something called Death Race. It was covered in the New York Times. The idea was that by, you know, driving over goblins would lead to more pedestrian fatalities on the roads of New York. And even here in the UK in the early 80s, there was legislation proposed to ban Space Invaders because it was hypnotizing the youth. What we find every time that we, you know, conduct research, you know, where we collect objective data or share our data and our code, is that a lot of that hype just doesn't have a basis in evidence.
So let's talk about this particular study you did. You looked at internet-based games, Animal Crossing, and Plants versus Zombies, and how they might impact a player's mental health. What did you find?
Well, we found a small but noteworthy positive correlation between the amount of time that players actually spend on each of those games and their reports of how they feel in terms of their well-being, using scales that psychologists use to measure these kinds of things. And, you know, it's nothing to write home about. You know, players who spend about 4 hours a day playing Animal Crossing, they also told us that they're happier people generally. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg because it's a correlation. We don't know which way it goes. It might just be that, you know, happier people have 4 hours during a pandemic to play a Nintendo game.
What is it about spending more time that brings that happiness?
So we tried to dig into this with some kind of more focused questions on players' motivations. And a key thing that psychologists like me look at is something called psychological needs. Whether or not a game or a relationship or a job has you feel competent, free to choose things that are important to you, and socially connected to others. Like, you belong. People are important to you. You're important to them. By far, the thing that we found was most important with these online games was this having a sense of social connection. What was key in our statistical models was this positive link between social connection and both enjoyment and well-being.
I wanted to ask you this. China, as you know, recently imposed restrictions on video games for minors. Chinese leader Xi Jinping said it was partly about video game addiction. Is China imposing that restriction based on incorrect data?
Yes, there are some really worrying signs about steps that are being taken in China and internationally with the World Health Organization around the idea that video games might be addictive. There's not particularly good evidence for it, and many of the decisions, many of the cures for gaming addiction are arguably much worse than the potential problem. These include, you know, gaming boot camps where young people have died, and some really questionable human rights practices, such as using facial recognition technology to limit playtime. And so, you know, the parent and the scientist in me is quite worried about the human rights implications of the way some countries are choosing to understand the World Health Organization's decisions on games.
So, Andrew, yours is one study, but is it your hope that this research changes the way people approach these questions about video games?
Our deeply held hope is that this is the first of hundreds of studies that use open data and industry data to answer questions about aggression, addiction, and mental health in games.
Andrew Shabilsky is the director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks so much for having me on.
In Greece, at this moment, there are more than 120,000 asylum seekers and refugees. For many of them, getting an education or finding work can be tough, impossible in some cases. The World's Lydia Manolidou reports on one nonprofit that's trying to change that by teaching computer programming.
Ahmed Sohail Hakior has always been kind of a computer nerd. When he was growing up in Afghanistan, his father would bring home old computers and he would tinker with them.
Most of the time I would really mess them up. And, you know, it was interesting to me. And then after that, I discovered video games. And even in my video games, I would sometimes try to change the game and modify some stuff.
Hakior and his family fled Afghanistan 5 years ago and came to Greece to seek asylum. At the refugee camp where they were placed when they first arrived, Hakior made a friend who told him about a free coding class for refugees. Hakior, who's now 18 and lives in the Athens area with his family, decided to give it a try.
And it was just, it was life-changing for me.
Over the course of 7 months, he learned full-stack development, basically how to build the front and back end of websites and apps. To graduate from this program, Hakior had to do a project. His was a social media platform for NGOs, so he walked away with a small portfolio. The program also gave him help on his resume and interview skills.
It's definitely given me confidence to, you know, stand up with my shoulders back. Because, you know, when you go from somebody who doesn't know anything to somebody who has at least one skill, it's a huge change.
Today, Hakior works as a developer for a company in London remotely. The nonprofit that offers this training is called Social Hackers Academy. They run their small operation out of a co-working space in downtown Athens. That's where I recently met co-founder and CEO Damian Vavanos.
This used to be our classroom.
Classes are now online because of the pandemic. Just outside on the building's terrace, Vavanos tells me about when he and his team started the project in 2017. He says at the time, there weren't any other nonprofits offering these classes to refugees, and they had to get the word out.
We were pretty much everywhere. Three people, the co-founders, with flyers all around Athens, wherever there was a refugee person. So, hustle. A lot of hustle. And we managed to get enough students to launch our classes.
At first, the school was exclusively for refugees. And the goal was to help them integrate into the Greek labor market, or the market of whatever country they ended up in.
Our very first class, we had a 16-year-old student. He was traveling for 3 years from Afghanistan. And he hadn't finished middle school. And he came here and he was this crazy genius guy. He learned more than what we taught him. And now he's in Germany. He has his job working as a developer.
Of the 150 students who have gone through the course, Social Hackers Academy says 60% have found jobs in a relevant field. They're not all refugees. Migrants and long-term unemployed people in Greece can now take the course as well.
It's quite challenging, but I really enjoy it. Yeah, I really, really, really like it so far.
Kiuri Negrau from Mozambique is one of the students in the current cohort. He's been in Greece for 3 years, came here because his partner's Greek, but he hasn't been able to find work.
It was very difficult, either because of the economy or the language barrier that I have still. I'm still trying to learn Greek.
He's also living in a country that has one of the highest, if not the highest, unemployment rates in the EU. And that's expected to get worse because of the pandemic. But Vovanos, the co-founder, and his team, they're banking on the fact that software developers are in high demand all over the world, and they can do their work remotely. Now, Social Hackers Academy is gearing up to bring classes to students outside of Greece.
The bold goals is by 2030 to be in every refugee camp around the world, because we want to be everywhere that people needs us.
It's an ambitious and maybe even unrealistic goal, one that experts say will come with lots of logistical challenges, like getting good enough internet and sustained power supply to the refugee camp classrooms. Vovano says to address some of that, they're partnering with NGOs already on the ground in the places where they want to expand. Their first stop will be two refugee camps in Kenya. They hope to have classes up and running there by the end of the year. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou in Athens, Greece.
Like the coding that happens for an app or a computer, there's a lot that goes on here at The World behind the scenes that you may not know about. With every story you hear, our now virtual newsroom aims to get to the heart of it and to share the voices of people affected by the headlines. When you have a moment in your busy day, meet our team. Just head to theworld.org/whoweare. The pandemic has hit small businesses hard, especially ones that were already struggling. Consider businesses, for example, that cater to marginalized groups like the LGBTQ community. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the uncertain future of queer bars.
Erica Rose remembers the first time she walked into the legendary Manhattan bar, Cubbyhole.
I like to say that Cubbyhole knew I was gay before I even did.
Cubbyhole, which is as small as its name suggests, opened up in 1994, and since then has been a safe space for queer women, transgender women, and non-binary people. On Erica's first visit, she was hooked.
It was the first time I had seen queer women not only just being romantic with each other, but being themselves in such an immediate and tangible way. It was a wake-up call and like rang the alarms in my head, oh, this is who you are, and I felt at home there.
That sentiment is widely shared within the queer community. But access to that experience is slipping away. LGBTQ bars are disappearing. In 2007, there were nearly 1,500 LGBTQ bars across the U.S. Now, there's less than 1,000. For bars catering to queer women, the plunge has been even steeper. The number went from 31 bars to just 15. Compare that to the 63,000 total bars in the U.S., and the same trend is seen across the pond.
We're studying things that are quite depressing and quite difficult.
Lo Marshall researches queer nightlife in London, where since 2006, 58% of LGBTQ venues have closed down.
When we were working out the figure, we sort of took a moment and sort of ran the figures again and again and again, thinking that's pretty drastic. It can't be that much. But yeah, it is.
Like in the US, bars for gay men have fared better than those for other members of the LGBTQ community. Lowe says just one lesbian bar still stands in London. But nailing down the reason for these global closures can be tough. To start, entrepreneurs who aren't men get a tiny fraction of investment money, so it's harder to open the doors in the first place. Plus, queer people get paid 16% less than cisgender straight people, according to a study in the UK. That means LGBTQ people can have less disposable income to spend on a night out. Then there are the dating apps. Queer adults are twice as likely as straight adults to use them, and therefore might not head to a bar to meet someone. But Lo Marshall says their research on queer nightlife points to something bigger.
LGBTQ venues have occupied spaces that no one else wanted to occupy, partly about accessibility, partly historically because of stigma. And those kinds of spaces have gone on to be regenerated or become gentrified.
This year, LGBTQ bars in London have gotten extra help from the government. But in other parts of the world, that's not a possibility.
No. No.
Adar Bozbay opened Bagudi, a queer bar in Istanbul, in 2008. After growing tired of facing harassment and judgmental looks in gay bars catering to men.
I want to create something for only women because we have no space in Turkey, we have no space in Istanbul.
For 10 years, Bagudi was the country's only bar for queer women. But Adar says it was hard to keep open. Police bothered her bar more than others. And although Adar often had a packed house, sometimes Bagudi didn't bring in that much cash. So a few years ago, Adar decided to open the bar up to the wider LGBTQ community and has faced a bit of backlash from the original patrons. They ask,
why you change it? This is not good. We was free, we was happy, and 5,000 bar in Turkey for all people, only bigudi for women. Why you change this?
After the switch, Adar did start making more money. But Bigudi has been closed since March, and Adar is nervous about its future.
I don't know how long we will stay open.
LGBTQ bars in the U.S. face the same uncertain road. The community is trying to help.
I remember a space I never knew existed.
Filmmakers Erica Rose and Alina Street have teamed up to direct the Lesbian Bar Project. They're raising money to celebrate and preserve the country's 15 remaining lesbian bars.
We have been defining lesbian bar as a space for all marginalized genders within the LGBTQ community.
In the Lesbian Bar Project's PSA, narrated by queer icon Leah Delaria, they pay tribute to bars of the past.
I remember being excited for the weekend. It was my playground. My family. I remember the lost spaces.
The absence of those spaces will be felt particularly hard during the holidays. Queer bars are known to stay open for those who aren't welcome at family gatherings. Erica and Alina say those places are more than a spot to grab a drink. They're landmarks. They're shelters. For many, they're home. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you had to choose one word to sum up this past year, what would it be? I could share my word if I were allowed to drop an expletive on the radio, but I can't. So, I don't know, 2020? Maybe you're also at a loss for words. The World's Sarah Birnbaum is not.
Every fall, the folks at Oxford University Press choose a word of the year, a word or phrase that captures the ethos or the mood. In 2019, it was climate emergency. In 2018, the word was toxic. Beating out incel and gaslighting. Then came 2020.
This past year, from a linguistic point of view, has been unprecedented.
That's Casper Grathwohl, the president of Oxford Dictionaries. In 2020, we saw new words emerge, historical words resurface, and technical words slip into the mainstream.
Personal protective equipment.
Super spreader.
Blur's date.
Anti-mask.
Doom scrolling.
These words that in any other year would have been great candidates for a word of the year, given how much their usage spiked. But there were dozens of those words this year.
And they just couldn't choose. That's because of how quickly the language changed. We can thank the seismic shifts in our lives for that. For example,
we now have words that didn't require qualification before, such as in-person voting.
In-person learning.
In-person gatherings here at the church.
Remember when we saw each other for reals? In the before times? That's another one, before times. Anyway, what's most remarkable to me is this, how there can be so many new words and phrases in our common parlance in a year that has so often left us speechless. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you right here tomorrow.